5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Flight cleared for takeoff.
Hello and welcome to Kentucky Caliber. I'm your host, Jason Belcher. This week, following the apparent second assassination attempt on former President Trump, this week we're going to be talking about the history of political violence in the United States, and we want to try to provide like a larger context for that. So not just American history, but also sort of a global perspective, because violence against, or rather political violence, is not something that's unique to the United States, even though it's pretty rare here relatively. It's more frequent on a global scale, and there are examples in the past from world history that we want to look at to provide some context for the recent events that we've witnessed here in the United States for the 2024 presidential election. But the first thing I wanted to talk about was just the significance of the peaceful transition of power, why that matters, and why it's something that democracy does better, or democratic forms of government does better than any other style of government or any other type of governing system. And when I say democracy, I'm talking about the root. By the way, the word democracy is two parts. The first part is demos, which is from the Greek meaning the people. Second part, krasi, which means to rule by. So when you put those two words together, it literally means rule by the people. That's what democracy is. A lot of folks will counter and say, well, yeah, but we're a republic here in the United States. And that's true, we are. But what is a republic? A republic is a representative form of government. And what that means is we choose elected officials to literally represent the views of their constituents in a national forum or national legislature, like Congress in our case. So that's, the two are not mutually exclusive. It's not an error to say, well, we're a democracy. No, we're not. We're a republic. We're both. So I hear that all the time, and it always kind of irks me. They're not mutually exclusive. We're both. Anyway, the reason why this peaceful transition of power is so important is because prior to the democratic style, or rather before democracies became so prevalent, that was the exception, right? There was frequent violence in order to secure the next generation of leadership or to become the next leader. So one of the big problems you have with monarchies, whether it's a king, a queen, an emperor, a prince, a princess, whatever, whenever you have a monarchy style of rule, one of the big problems with that is what happens when the monarch dies, right? So one of the things monarchy does very well is it lets the people know who the ruler is. We know who's in charge. It's the king or the queen or the emperor or the sultan in the Ottoman Empire's case. We know who they are. So it's very clearly identified who's in charge, and there's a very clear chain of command from that single ruler all the way down to the lower level officials that work on their behalf. So it does that very well. One of the things it does very poorly is solve the problem of succession. In other words, what happens after the monarch dies? Who's going to be in charge after the death of the monarch? Now, sometimes the monarch will designate an heir while they're still alive. And usually, not always, but usually that carries with it a pretty solid weight of legitimacy for the subjects of that, whatever it's a realm or a kingdom or whatever they call it. Usually if they designate an heir, that heir has a better chance of taking the throne and keeping it for at least a while. But what happens when they don't, right? So there can be disputes about who's supposed to be in charge. And frequently throughout history, very frequently, those disputes have turned violent. Now, there's so many examples, I'm not even going to try to cover all of them, but I do want to highlight a few of the more well-known ones just because they illustrate it so well. For instance, in the War of the Roses in England in the 15th century, this was the result of a succession dispute within the Plantagenet dynasty. So Edward III died without a clear heir, and that led to a struggle between the houses of York and Lancaster, which were two different branches of the Plantagenets, and that resulted in a series of civil wars which lasted over 30 years. And that's not an isolated case. In other parts of the world, for example, the Mughal Empire in India, there was a huge period of decline after the death of the Emperor Aurangzeb, who left behind a disputed succession. So his sons ended up fighting a bloody war of succession, which not only led to the death of many heirs, but it also weakened the empire itself, and that made it much more susceptible to invasions and internal rebellions. The Ottoman Empire is another example. They did have a clear rule of succession, but there were times under the Ottomans where one of the brothers or one of the siblings of the heir would challenge them, and that ended up in violent conflict as well. And then even when there was a clearly designated ruler, which was the case with Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, whenever that designated successor was so weak or ineffective, in that case, it generated so much popular discontent that it led to an uprising, which culminated with the Russian Revolution and the end of the Romanov dynasty itself. So in that case in Russia, they got rid of the monarchy altogether, and they instituted a completely new system of government that we would today call the nation state. The nation state, of course, is something that's relatively new in world history. Prior to that, you had kingdoms that were ruled by a monarch, or back to the time of the Greeks, you had city-states, which had various schemes of rule. I mean, the Athenians had democracy, but in a pure sense. When they practiced democracy, what they meant was they met in the assembly, and when they voted on something, for example, if the Athenians voted to go to war, they didn't vote to send somebody else to war. That vote had a direct impact on the people in that assembly, right? So when the Athenians voted for war, it means the next day they were going to war themselves. So they had democracy, but at a city-state level. The nation-state, as we understand it today, which means a government that exercises the authority over a clearly defined geographic area or territory, that came about after the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, which ended the 30 Years' War. And by the way, the 30 Years' War, of course, was one of the bloodiest conflicts in European history. And it's significant for the United States because that conflict was so devastating, so bloody, and led to so much death and suffering that it helped push a lot of people from Europe out of the European continent. So many of the folks who left to come to North America, which they called the New World at that time, because they didn't know it was inhabited. At that time, though, they called it the New World, and they wanted to come here for religious freedom. And the reason they sought religious freedom was because they did not want to be subjected to the kind of brutality that they knew had just happened during the 30 Years' War. So the 30 Years' War helped to push Europeans across the Atlantic Ocean, at least for folks who just wanted to find someplace else to live. That was one of the reasons why folks sought to escape from Europe. That was the 30 Years' War. But that treaty that ended that, the Treaty of Westphalia, created the modern nation state. And so the modern nation state works differently from monarchies that we've seen in the past, where there was a king or a queen and then there had to be a fight over succession. If we fast forward to today in countries like the United States or France or Britain, we have elections. And so we know there's a process that's in place to select who the next head of state will be. We don't have to worry about if they have an heir or not. We don't have to worry about who they've designated. It's not up to them. It's up to the voters. It's up to the people. Back to that democracy again, demos kreisi, rule by the people. It's up to the voters to decide who will be the next ruler. And so one of the effects that the democratic system has had is it has reduced the instances of political violence when it comes to who's going to be the next in charge or who's going to be the next to lead the government. It still happens. We have political violence, which is the topic today, but it's far less frequent. And when it does happen, it's far less deadly than the examples that I talked about in the past. And by the way, I only highlighted a few, very few examples. There are literally hundreds, maybe thousands of examples. You could spend a whole day just talking about political violence based on secession in China, because they had a land-based system And so a lot of disputes ended up turning violent because of who was in, who would, the dispute was over who would own the land, therefore who would be the ruler. So in China alone, you've probably had hundreds of instances. You've had lots of instances in other parts of Asia and Europe. So the bottom line is, the problem of secession is a big deal. It's a really big deal for people who live in the territory that's governed or ruled by the monarch. And the democratic system has solved that problem with elections, regularly scheduled elections. And so we have those. We've been having those here in the United States for well over 200 years. And during that time, in every presidential election except one, we've seen a peaceful transition of power from one administration to the next, from one elected leader to the next. They don't have to like each other, and they frequently didn't. They frequently did not like each other or their successors' ideas at all. But they always, until 2021, recognized that the winner had the majority vote, and that means they get to be president, and the loser has to go home. They're no longer president. Until 2021, that was never disputed violently in the United States. We have had instances of political violence in terms of assassination attempts, but thankfully, they've been relatively rare. They do happen, and when they did happen, they caused a significant impact on the country, absolutely. But if you look at the what's happened and how long the United States has been around and how many assassination attempts there have actually been, the reality is, by the numbers, they're not that common in American history. They're fairly rare. We've had four presidents who were killed in office, and those four were Lincoln, Garfield, McKinley, and JFK. Ronald Reagan survived an assassination attempt while he was in office, making him the only president to do so. There have been other presidents who were, there have been other attempts made on presidents, but they weren't, who then they survived, but they weren't in office at the time. Teddy Roosevelt was one. And by the way, he was a former president running for what would have been his third term, which at that time was still legal. He was giving a speech and he was hit by an assassin's bullet, which in the chest. But thankfully for him, he had a copy of his speech that was folded up in one of his pockets. And the bullet hit that first, which slowed it down. And so the wound was much less severe than it otherwise would have been. And by the way, when he was shot during that speech, Teddy Roosevelt went ahead and gave the address, even though he'd been shot in the chest. He continued to speak for another hour and a half before he went to seek medical attention. Also, recently, former President Trump, there was an assassination attempt in Pennsylvania that wounded him slightly, I think, in the ear. And then this most recent one in Florida, although it's not clear that the shooter ever actually got a look at him. In fact, I've seen reports today that suggested that the shooter in Florida never actually had eyes on former President Trump. So he never actually had a line of sight. I don't know if legally that makes it an assassination attempt or not, but the other charges that he's facing, the gun charges, will probably stick regardless. There have been other assassination attempts. The very first one was Andrew Jackson in 1835. Andrew Jackson, by the way, being one of the few presidents we've had who actually fought and won a duel. He had actually shot and killed a fellow plantation owner in a duel. Now, his reputation was pretty gruff, and he cultivated that. He was reputed to have been in lots of other duels, but I only know of one for sure that he took part in, and he actually won that one. And he fired and killed a fellow plantation owner over a dispute they were having. He was also known, Andrew Jackson was also known to wear these really large overcoats. And so they made his shoulders look much bigger than he actually was. And that wasn't to intimidate his opponent. That was to make it hard for them to tell, you know, if they were aiming at, shooters, you know, were always taught to aim at the center of mass. That's what they taught us in the military. But when you're wearing this gigantic overcoat, then you can't really tell where the center of mass is, right? It's sort of a way to keep yourself from getting shot or make it less likely. So he did that. And that may have contributed to his surviving the first duel that I know he's been in. Anyway, there've been at least a dozen other attempts on presidents that we know of, probably more, that were unsuccessful. 14 members of Congress have been assassinated in office since 1789, which was when the first Congress met. And 14 more have been wounded by assassination attempts during that same time. All right, sorry, I wanted to get a drink of water there. Interestingly, for governors, according to the information that I have and what I've been able to find, only one sitting governor has ever been assassinated while in office, and that was in Kentucky, right here in my home state, in the year 1900. And that was when William Goble was assassinated in Frankfort. Now, according to the Kentucky Historical Society, which is where I'm getting this bit of information from, because this one is actually a pretty interesting story. Goble's assassination was following a disputed gubernatorial election that year between himself and William Taylor, who was the attorney general. Goble had been a state senator prior to running for governor, and Taylor was the returning attorney general. The Board of Elections, which had been established by a law Goble helped pass prior to running for the governor, actually certified Taylor as the winner, and he was inaugurated. And then after that, the Democratic majority in the General Assembly voted to investigate the election. And before the committee could decide, Goble was shot while walking across the Capitol grounds. So Taylor then declared a state of emergency and called out militia. And that meant that Democratic legislators who didn't accept Taylor's action couldn't get into the Capitol building because they were barred by troops from actually getting there or any other public places. So they met in secret at the Capitol Hotel in January, according to the Historical Society, on January 31st, and they unanimously accepted the report of the contest committee, declared that Goble was the governor, and swore him in. So that meant Kentucky at that time essentially had two opposing governments, and the state appeared to be headed towards its own civil war. When Goble died on February 3rd, he lived for about 3 days after he was shot. His lieutenant governor took office, and eventually the dispute after that, both Republicans and Democrats agreed to let the court settle it. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the Democratic majority, leaving Beckham the governor. And Taylor, after that, fled the state while Beckham remained in the governor's office. That's a pretty interesting story, because it's unclear to me. First of all, we don't know who the assassin actually was. Like, there were people who were charged and convicted in the assassination itself, but even those cases were not able to determine who actually pulled the trigger. So to this day, it remains unknown who actually shot Goble at that time, and there was never a name announced, and it was never found. You had a situation where the parties were disputing the outcome of election over, they were both trading allegations of fraud, and you had a case where armed citizens entered the Capitol in order to prevent the opposing party from changing the outcome of the election, which actually ended up happening anyway. Why was there no subsequent violence after that? I think that's a question that I can't answer fully, but my suspicion is, after seeing, you know, after walking right up to the brink and seeing what that looked like, I think people decided that it would be better just to go home and come back and try again, you know, at the next election cycle rather than settle things with weapons. And that's important, right? Because that's one of the appeals of democracy, is we decide the election outcomes by ballots, not by bullets. Ballots are a peaceful way. And that doesn't mean, by the way, that the process is smooth or isn't unsightly to watch. That doesn't mean that people aren't telling lies all the time, exaggerating, making up events, spreading false rumors or gossips. All of that has always been part of the election process, and it always will be. But all of that is still less problematic and less concerning than an actual fight, a physical contest where the outcome is decided by force instead of by persuasion. And that's the appeal of the democratic process. So we still do that, right? Even though each side will accuse the other of lying, each side will accuse the other, or there could be more than two, but usually there's two here in the U.S. You know, usually the two major parties, nominees for office, whether it's president, governor, or Congress, or even at the state level, usually that's how it gets decided, by persuasion. There have been instances of political violence directed against lower level officials, including mayors or city councilmen and some judges. Altogether, I can find about 58 or 60 instances of actual assassination attempts against sitting officials at different levels of the government, whether it's, you know, the city council level or at the state level with the governor or Congress or the president. So if you think about how many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, and probably thousands since the United States was founded, have held office, the fact that so few have been, relatively few have been assassinated speaks to the efficacy of the democratic system. It's less violent and more stable than the monarchy systems or the monarchic systems of individual one person or family rule that preceded it. And when I mentioned family rule, I'm talking about the dynasties, because that tended to happen too, right? That was, in fact, when I mentioned the English War, the War of the Roses, that was actually an internal family struggle between two different sides of a family. So the dynastic struggle also had a tendency, dynasties also had a tendency to turn violent when there was a dispute over the outcome of an election. So even though it's terrible to see any instance of political violence, we should remember the context of that it's still pretty rare, and that our system is much safer, much more stable than what we've seen across most of human history. And I hope that serves as a reminder of how valuable, not just how effective, but how valuable our system is. We want to keep it because it works, right? It works. It's a working system that leads to a way to settle differences or disputes without resorting to gunfire or, you know, armies clashing or large numbers of people being killed. That is something, purely from a political standpoint, that is rare in democratic societies. Of course, we had the Civil War. We could have a whole separate discussion on that. But even during the Civil War, when Abraham Lincoln was elected, no one from the Confederacy suggested that Abraham Lincoln didn't have the right to be president. They just wanted to separate and form a different, separate nation. But they didn't dispute Lincoln's right to be president of the Union. So even during the Civil War, no one questioned that. And that's when bullets and cannons were firing at each other and under much more difficult circumstances, that we have today. So what that means going forward, I hope, is that as we approach November and as we get closer to the actual presidential election in 2024, the speculation for a disputed election is pretty high. And here's what I mean by that. A contested election simply means that it's a close race. Like, there's usually at least two candidates and the voters are pretty evenly split. And when you count them up, it's going to be real close as to who won. That's a contested election. A disputed election, which often follows from contested elections, involves a legal challenge to the results. So now we're going beyond just a close vote count. Now there's a legal issue at stake to determine the way the votes have been counted or how many votes are counted or who the winner is, right? So that's a disputed election. Disputed elections that are solved in the court system are still a peaceful transition of power. Even though there was a disagreement or a legal concern about the outcome or the results, none of the disputed parties were shooting at each other, right? They went to court to settle it. The only time it turns violent is when we decide, or when the people decide, that they're not going to accept the vote count or the ruling of the court or the actions of the government. And they decide that they're going to contest that with violence. And that's when it becomes a violently disputed election. That's what we don't want here in the United States. That's what we don't need, because we've been doing this for a long time. And even though January 6th was an attempt to change the results of an election using force, it was unsuccessful. And I've also had a lot of people tell me, well, January 6th can't be counted as a coup attempt because they weren't, the people that were doing it didn't have guns. Well, first of all, yes, they did. They did have weapons stored nearby. And critics would counter that and say, well, they didn't actually use firearms when they went into the Capitol. That's true, they didn't. But they still used force. When you bust down windows and kick down doors and assault police with blunt objects, that's still using force. And so they attempted to forcefully disrupt the proceedings of the U.S. Congress in certifying the 2020 elections. In fact, their specific goal was to prevent certification so they could name Donald Trump the winner, even though he lost. And he has now finally admitted that he lost. Took 4 years to get there, but at least he finally has admitted it. If you think back to 2000, during another contested and disputed election, then it was the Democrats who were saying that there's a legal basis not to accept the victory of their opponent. That case went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled against Al Gore. And what did he do after that? He conceded the race. So that's a huge difference between 2000 and 2020, is that the party on the dispute, when the court ruled against them, he conceded the race. And that was it. Once Al Gore conceded the race, it became impossible for his remaining supporters to argue that he should still be president. Your own candidate has said that he lost and it's over. So that ended the dispute. That's something that Donald Trump did not do in 2020. And because he did not do that, because he continued to spread falsehoods that he had won, that there was fraud, which there was not, that contributed to the violence on January 6th. And I say contributed to because grown adult human beings are still responsible for their actions. So the people who went there made a decision to go there on their own, and they're still responsible for their actions. Many of them under oath stated they were there because President Trump asked them to, but it's still there. It was still their choice to go. So I still believe that because of individual responsibility and because they made that decision themselves, they are the ones who are responsible and should be, as they have been in court and through the legal system, held accountable, as should former President Trump. That was the basis of his second impeachment, which we know the result of that was an acquittal. But he was still charged. So a lot of folks before his felony conviction have said to me, well, he's never been charged with trying to overturn election results. And I said, yes, he has. That's what the second impeachment was. So what we don't want to see after November of 2024 is violence. What I think we're very likely to see is a disputed election, and a legally disputed election. What I mean by that is it'll be disputed in court. It could be at the state level, federal level, state and federal level simultaneously. There could be multiple ongoing court cases that make that the final result count. It could be a while before we get a resolution, a legal resolution on who the winner is. And I would further expect that during that time, both sides, especially former President Trump, because this is what he does. We've been watching him do this for a while. This is his third in a row presidential campaign, so we know how he works. He will almost immediately declare that he won, will not wait for the courts, and he will accuse the courts of being fraudulent if they don't rule in a way that he wants. Well, that's not how democracy works. The process is what counts, not the outcome. You don't always get the outcome you want. Nobody does every time. But the process itself is what has to be respected. I don't expect former President Trump to do that, at least not initially. I expect him to say that he won or that there's fraud, or he'll make up some other fictitious claim, and he'll continue repeating that in the hopes that he can stir up enough popular discontent to try to goad people into taking action at the state level the way we saw them do on January 6th. So I think what his strategy is to get people to go to state capitals and have January 6th style incidents happening at state capitals to try to bully the legislatures there or the state government there into declaring that the outcome is actually in their favor, even if that's not what the vote count represents. But I think ultimately, if we stick with the system, the legal system, even though there's been a lot of attempts since 2020 to change things. And I'll give you an example, a real quick one, is the Georgia law, which now, the way it's written, will allow the state board of elections to stop certification simply because they suspect that there has been fraud. And that's important because there's already a mechanism to deal with voter fraud. The state attorney general's office are the ones that you call to investigate fraud, and there are standards of evidence that have to be applied in order for those allegations to be either ruled substantiated or unsubstantiated. What's different about the Georgia law is it removes the court requirement, it removes the evidentiary requirement, and it allows the state board to decide whether or not they think there might have been fraud without having to provide any evidence to the public or anyone else. The sole purpose of that legislation, by the way, in Georgia, is to prevent the certification is to prevent an election to be certified where Donald Trump was not the winner. So the sole purpose of that legislation is to try to give him the state of Georgia in the 2024 election. I don't think it'll survive a court challenge. I think it will take a long time, and it'll be frustrating, and it will be slow, and that slowness and that frustration will allow tempers to flare and rhetoric to fly. And in those inflamed conditions with a presidential election hanging in the balance, I think it's quite possible that we could see incidents of violence, whether it's, you know, protests or riots or assassination attempts. I think it's quite possible that we will witness some of those things take place in the aftermath of this election, the 2024 election. But I think ultimately, as in 2020, the system will hold. And the court rulings will be the ones that make the decisive, the outcome will still be decisive. So I think my prediction is there will be a lot of frustration. There will be a lot of court challenges. There quite likely could be some isolated incidents of violence or civil disobedience or civil unrest. But at the end of the day, I think the democratic system that we have will prevail as it did in 2020, because our institutions proved that they could handle that type of assault and come through under those circumstances. They did in 2020, and I think they will again in 2024. And we should be thankful for the strength of our institutions. You don't see that in countries like Venezuela, who don't have strong institutions, and instead you've seen a president lose an election but then lie about winning it and still remain in power, because the institutions of Venezuela are weak and they don't have the strength to remove him from office peacefully the way, or change the outcome, I should say, peacefully, the way that institutions in the United States do. So I guess I'm an optimist. End of the day, I've studied the democratic process. It's worked for a long time in America. I expect it's going to keep working. It won't be a smooth ride at all. I don't expect that. I think it's going to be a very bumpy ride through the 2024 elections. But I truly hope that everyone will respect the rule of law, the court decisions, and the count of the ballots, and that we'll settle this election by ballots, not bullets, because that's the American way. That's the American way. That's how we do things here. That is how we've done things in the past, and that is how we want to do things in the future. And anyone who says differently is expressing a view that is itself un-American. And so that's what I hope to see. That's what I expect to see in this election. We may add to the legacy of political violence that we've seen, that's been a part of American history since our founding, but it's been relatively rare, and in each instance, the system still overcame it. And so that's what I think will happen in 2024. And that's all I wanted to talk about today. I appreciate you listening, and I hope you have a great day. Thanks.